David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks, and welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 342. I'm your host, Steve Raker, hunkered down in the comic book bunker, where I'm keeping the airways clean and the multiverse in order. This episode, Andrew the L.A. Rabbit is going to join me, and we'll cover a chunk of old Bronze Age comics. Marvel Team-Up number 12 through number 17, and Daredevil 103. That slips in there. You'll see why. First, though, I want to remind you that Marvel Noise is part of the Deliberate Noise Network that has lots of other good noise-related and not-noise-related shows, including Indie Comic Book Noise, which is the sister show to this one, where we talk about the indie comics we've been digging on. You can find Marvel Noise episodes on marvelnoise.com, including old episodes. There's a handy little drop-down menu on the right-hand side amongst all of the other clutter. You can get announcements on new episodes and gallery images, etc. on Facebook and Twitter. We're all coping with the COVID restrictions so far, hoping that the 2020 Baltimore Comic Con in late October will still be on. It's such a great show. Great forum to meet your favorite, and my favorite, funny book creators. You can check out details at BaltimoreComicCon.com. You know, when Marvel's comics with the End banner on them started coming out in the early 2000s, they reminded me a lot of the What If comics of my youth in the 70s and early 80s. They were, for the most part, double-sized one-shots, telling the tale of a possible future ending for our heroes. Some are pretty apocalyptic. I mean, heck, most of those what-ifs didn't end too well, if I remember correctly. But some had positive endings, or legacy endings, with the next generation carrying on, or someone younger somehow carrying the torch of a fallen Marvel hero. A lot like those what-ifs. The first one was The Incredible Hulk, The End in 2002, written by Peter David, with art by Dale Keown and Joe Weems. Makes sense to have David and Keown being the creative team for the Hulk's last story after their historic handlings of the character. So this is basically Banner. He's making a recording while he wanders around a post-nuclear Holocaust landscape. He's the last man alive, but soon there will be only Hulk, right? The next year, in 2003, and carrying over into 2004, there was a six-issue cosmic epic by Jim Starlin and Al Milgrom, Marvel Universe, The End. This was a fantastic storyline. I love it to death. A lot of fun. And I talked about it in depth more than 10 years ago on Marvel Noise episode 92 from September 14th, 2009, and part two was on Marvel Noise 94, which was October 5th, 2009, and finished it up in Marvel Noise 96 on October 19th from 2009. That same year, 2003, saw another six-issue The End limited series, this one Wolverine, handled by Paul Jenkins with art by Claudio Castellini. It's not so much Wolverine's end, but more like a bookend to Jenkins's origin limited series. You know, it's back to the Howlets and Rose and Wolvie's origins. In 2004, there was a one-shot by Garth Ennis and Richard Corbin, The Punisher, The End. It's another post-nuclear Holocaust landscape with The Punisher fighting his way back to New York City and encountering survivors along the way. A lot of punishing going on. Everyone needs a little punishment. Then, in 2004, 2005, and 2006, there was what I felt to be excessive, the X-Men the end. It was a trilogy of 6-issue limited series. There was X-Men Dreamers and Demons in 04, X-Men Heroes and Martyrs in 05, and X-Men Men and X-Men in 2006, written by none other than Chris Claremont, with art by Sean Chen and Sandu Floria. This one lost me in the second series. It was all just too much. Too much, Chris. Lots of Shi'ar, lots of Next Generation X-Men. Nice art by Chen and Floria, I gotta say. I really liked 2006 and 2007 6-issue Fantastic Four The End limited series, written and drawn by Alan Davis and Mark Farmer. The FF are all split up, lots of guest stars as we check in to see where they're at and what they're up to and who they're hanging out with, but they all reunite in the end. You hear what I did there? In 2008, there was Iron Man The End, where it was written by David Michelinie and Bob Layton, with art by Bernard Chang and Bob Layton, with an aging, ailing Tony making this great space elevator achievement, but it's sabotaged by Roxxon, and another scientist, Nick Travis, must take the reins and become the new Iron Man for a new generation. But written by Michelinie and Layton, the Iron Man creative team of the last generation. And then the last of this first wave of The End stories was Spider-Girl The End in 2010, written by Tom DeFalco, with art by Ron Frenz. Who else but these two would tell the last Mayday Parker story? She's facing her venomized clone, April. April, Mayday, April Parker. But now, here in the opening months of 2020, Marvel has revisited the End concept with 6 new one-shots. There's Captain America, which was my favorite of the bunch, written and drawn by Eric Larson. So much fun. It's an older Cap fighting in the world of zombie, well, Red Skull-infected people. Can he find the source and make the ultimate sacrifice? It's all Larson channeling Kirby fun. Also, Venom, written by Adam Warren, with art by Jeffrey Chamba Cruz. This was very wordy. A lot goes on here. It's very cosmic and generation spawning. Not so much sequential, more like a lot of spot panels and accompanying text in caption boxes. Interesting, though. Miles Morales, The End, written by Saladin Ahmed, with art by Damian Scott. I didn't read this one, but the solicit describes humanity making its last stand in Brooklyn. Doctor Strange, The End, written by Leah Williams, with art by Felipe Andrade. Doc knows his time is up. He's old. He gathers the remains of various mystics, digs them up and stuff, and carries around their bones in a box. It's kind of like Hellboy with the witch head or head lopper carrying around the talking head. He kind of talks to the big burden that he's carrying around, and eventually he passes the torch to Ileana Rasputin as the new Sorcerer Supreme. Captain Marvel, The End, written by Kelly Thompson, with art by Carmen Carnero. Cap is out in space being Cap, longing for the old days when there was life on Earth and stuff. But then her Avengers assemble, her card rings, like, for the alert. And she was like, oh my gosh, the survivors. So she goes back and helps them in their plight after reuniting with them. And then she does the whole Hal Final Night thing. And the last of the bunch, at least so far, was Deadpool, which was also a good one, written by Deadpool writer extraordinaire Joe Kelly, with art by Mike Hawthorne and Victor Olazaba. This was, as you would expect, a pretty fun romp that includes a lot of different heroes and a lot of different craziness. There's no real description of the narrative that I can offer that will somehow make you grasp a hold of what goes on in this book. Definitely worth checking out, though. The Captain America one and the Deadpool ones were my favorite of this bunch. But these were 6 good additions overall to the End publishing concept. Fun and futuristic. Although, they don't often end well, do they? Alright, Andrew, you're back as promised to talk about a chunk of Marvel team-up issues. Old Marvel team-up issues.
Well, Steve, I was inspired. I know you've been doing those segments lately, following up on Iron Man and Human Torch. And then I had a vague recollection of us covering, and I thought we'd covered a whole bunch, but it turns out sharp-eared listeners of Marvel Noise that go back to episode 335 of September last year will note that we only covered the first three. So maybe not as far as I thought we got, but I like these Marvel team-up issues a lot. And there's some personal connections to them that I'll get to when we get to the issues. So I felt like this was a good batch, and I didn't think we'd got it. And I'm making sure we're not covering any of the Torch or Iron Man ones.
I think I still owe a half a segment on the rest of the Torch issues. But you know what it is, though? You read a chunk of these issues together, and then it starts getting formulaic in some ways, right? Like you need some sort of connecting narrative after a while. It's hard to read too many in a row. Picking them up off the stands was one thing. I mean, when we were adolescents in the early 80s reading them, you know, Marvel team-up was almost to issue 100 and then also beyond until the series ended with 150. So by then, we totally knew what the deal was with Marvel team-up, right? I mean, there was going to be some sort of way that they got the characters together, and we just pretty much accepted the formula. But reading these old issues, this is issues 12 through 17 from the summer to the end of the fall of 1973, before our time as readers, and really when the whole Marvel team-up deal hadn't been totally established. You know, it was the second Spider-Man book. There was no Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man yet, and I don't think there was a Marvel 2-in-1 yet. So they were really breaking new ground with how do we get these heroes together and how much do we want to make it be a showcase of the other hero and his supporting cast. And it's interesting the way they play around with it.
And part, if you want to follow along at home, along with the Marvel Unlimited, I picked these out of the Marvel Masterworks Volume 2. I thought that was a good, because I didn't think we'd made it past Volume 1, so I figured that was safe. And what's nice is both Volume 1 and Volume 2 have nice intros by Roy Thomas, who at the time would have been ascending to take over, because Stan, while still nominally around, like this is the time when he's going and doing all the college campuses, and I don't know how much he was really plugged into, well, I mean, he was still contributing, but we see as it gets less and less, and I'm always wary about how much Stan's involvement by the early 70s really was.
Yeah, once he wasn't writing Spidey anymore in FF, you know, he was done with it all.
But they always like to mention that they would loop him in or get an idea or whatever from him, I think. And I'm always like, I don't know how much of an idea it was or whatever.
He was still like approving covers and stuff, you know, and giving his input along those lines as far as what new magazines to do and what comics to cancel and that kind of stuff. He was still in the loop in that sort of executive editorial kind of way. But these issues, like you said, are also on the Marvel Unlimited digital service, which is awfully handy. Issue 12 is written by Jerry Conway with a script by Len Wein, with art by Ross Andrew and Don Perlin. It's Spidey and the Werewolf by Night.
And not to date myself, as the joke goes, but for me as a youth, while I had the reprints of Ditko, Andrew and Gil Kane were probably the ones I most associate as Spider-Man artists from my very young age. And at this point, I wasn't getting, I mean, obviously this is before my time, but as we move on, I wouldn't be able to buy my own comics, but people would sometimes give them to me, or the dentist might have them, or things like that. And I wasn't great at reading them, necessarily, but I really liked, you know, Spider-Man was just, for whatever reason, maybe the Electric Company or whatever, I just responded to him more than any other comic book character.
Issue 12 opens with Spidey in San Francisco, trying to cross the Golden Gate Bridge. He's taking the high road, of course. And halfway across, he gets attacked by the werewolf.
Just one quick, I'll get this out of the way. I can't get over the Jack Russell being his name because the dog is called. It really drives me nuts. I'm like, really? Like, Jack Russell Terrier Wolfman?
He's the werewolf by night.
I really hate the Jack Russell name. Other than that, great character, but it's always a stumbling block for me with such an obvious joke name. I never like that. But anyways, yes, he's a fearsome opponent and ambushes Spider-Man. Go ahead, Steve.
I like saying werewolf by night, like Pat Summerall used to say, murder, she wrote. That was always the pause.
Murder, she wrote.
Spidey's attacked by the werewolf, and they have a 6-page tussle that, I mean, admittedly, it's loaded with dialogue. In fact, looking at the 6 issues, these 6 pages, they could all be completely scriptless, and they would all make perfect sense.
Yes, but I have such a juvenile fondness for thought balloons that I'm fine with Spidey running a little recap in his head about what's going on and how his movements are happening. But I really do enjoy, this is that era when Spider-Man would oftentimes have his camera and his little clothes on his back and just fun. A Robbie Robertson with the pipe, J. Jonah Jameson with a cigar, things we're not going to see eventually when they remove smoking implements from heroes.
And why Spider-Man in San Francisco? At this time, in his own mag, he is getting over Gwen Stacy's death and the Green Goblin dying and all that. And so he is looking for an out-of-town job, and J. Jonah Jameson begrudgingly gives him one to go get the goods on Daredevil and the Black Widow, who are operating out of San Francisco.
That was a fun era. I don't know if Kevin has talked about it, being our resident Daredevil expert.
No, but someday I really want to, because those were the issues that I chased down as back issues when I was a youth. I really like the Daredevil, Black Widow, Double Bill.
Yes.
You know?
Great. Two very complementary characters in a way that's interesting. I mean, they've gone Black Widow completely super spy nowadays, but back then it was a nice mix of her. And some great outfits. I'm always fond of her original outfit.
I know.
But you can't fault the full suit.
Yeah, I mean, the all blue and then Daredevil's all red, right?
Yeah.
I mean, come on. Marvel loves like their red and blue.
The old Stinger, too, that she with the kind of bigger ones on her wrist. Yeah, perfect design.
So during the tussle with the werewolf on the Golden Gate Bridge, the werewolf lunges at Spidey and he ends up taking the big fall into the drink. Splunch. And then as Peter, Spidey is entering the city and he's seeing that everybody seems really zoned out. And then he's attacked again by the werewolf. Knocks him out. He reverts to being Jack. And then he gets to talk to Jack and hear what the story is. Jack and his sister and his best friend saw, I mean, a fantastic marquee for a show at the Baiju, Andrew. It's live today, on stage, Occult Magic.
I wasn't appreciative of his description of the act, as figured it was one of those cheap top hat and bunny type acts. Hey, those are fine quality magical acts, as a person who enjoys magic.
But if you're a werewolf, right, like recovering from the last lunar cycle, as he said, are you going to go to the show that is the onstage occult? Like, what could go wrong, right?
Well, you know, that stuff isn't real, Steve. All werewolves know that magic is fake, so.
Unfortunately, this Svengali, a self-described Svengali named Moondark, his first appearance, he actually had subsequent ones. He's a real mysticist. He's a sorcerer type, like a low-level sorcerer.
I like his eye black. There's like a combination eye black and mask because it extends past his face. Like, it's a fun, you know, a fun design of, because he's wearing the traditional suit that they always put the magicians in. Like, kind of think of the Distinguished Competition and Zatanna and all those ones.
Moondark puts everyone in the audience in a trance and abducts Jack and company. Then he sends the werewolf to take out Spidey twice. Spidey's like, I'm not even supposed to be here today. actually three times, because now as they arrive at Moondark's lair, Jack furs up and then attacks Spider-Man again.
Yeah, what's enjoyable about this team-up is at no point does the werewolf ever help Spider. Like, normally the Marvel formula is they fight at the beginning, then they help. And this one, the werewolf's always going to fight Spider-Man. So that I appreciated.
Yeah, well, it's pretty good. Out of a 19-page story, they managed to depict Spider-Man and the werewolf fighting on 9 of them. Like, that's half the issue, is them fighting at one time or another. That's pretty cool. That's what you want to see, right? That's the price of admission.
These nice, intricate, as we've talked about to death, the sort of attack and counterattack. It's not, you know, a big splash with fancy poses or whatever. It's them engaging in a fight, or how I think of comic book fights.
Moondark is laughing at his enemy. His enemy who's come to thwart his plans, and Spidey's all like, what? I don't even know who you are. But Spidey dropkicks Moondark into the mists of passage, and he and Spidey disappear, like Spidey's momentum carries him in too. Jack wonders where they end up, and where they end up is the same place that Moondark's used the mists of passage, presumably, to send the werewolf to get Spidey. They're at the Golden Gate Bridge, up high, and Spidey grabs hold, but Moondark falls to his apparent death. And, I mean, Spidey, I guess, could have webbed to try to save him, but he just did that with Gwen, like, 2 months ago, and that didn't work so good. So
Well, they make it clear that he, in a very nice panel, I thought, he's barely caught one of the support cables by his left hand, and his right was in no position to pick the guy up, and I thought that was a dynamic pose.
And the issue ends with a plug for Daredevil 103.
I will say one thing that, in reading these in hindsight, I love, like, werewolf by night, occult symbols, pentagrams. Like, a short 10 years later, America would become obsessed with, like, kids being exposed to the occult and secret Satan. And I just love that these 70s Marvel are chock full of what, you know, would drive parents groups crazy they 10 years
just,
later.
They just started letting them do it again, too, right?
Because for those of you, yeah, there's some funny stuff in the 80s about how everyone thought that, like, there were millions of, like, satanic cults recruiting kids, and D&D was the devil's work. Just all this.
Yeah, the music lyrics and everything.
All this ridiculous stuff. But, man, if you can get your hands on 70s Marvel, you'll get all the black magic you need.
So in Daredevil 103, with that sports an awesome Don Heck, John Romita Sr. cover, where they took the Black Widow from this cover and used it on the 7-Eleven Slurpee cup for the Black Widow in the 70s. That was like her, you know, regular IP image to be used.
It's a good look. They do include this one. Strangely enough, it's the only non-Marvel team-up issue in Volume 2, but they slot it right in, which makes sense because now you get to see Spider-Man unofficially team up with Daredevil and Black Widow, and this time maybe they're not just going to beat each other up for the old issue. Although Ramrod is not a villain that I'm going to be following with a lot of intense.
Daredevil 103 is written by Steve Gerber with art by Don Heck and Sal Trapini. So Spidey's in San Francisco, right, to get the goods on Daredevil, and he cases out the Black Widow's mansion. And when she and Daredevil get home, he changes to Peter Parker and tries the civil route and just goes and knocks on the door. They greet him fondly and start to give him the exclusive that he wants. Then Ramrod first appearance of Ramrod, attacks and pretty much kicks their butt and steals some papers that are important. And Ramrod, he's like a knockoff Juggernaut type.
So, Steve, you're telling me this is a really expensive issue for me to track down if it's the first appearance of Ramrod? Very uninteresting, though. Basically, a little bit of minimal armor around his upper torso, and that's it. And, like, pants and boots. They did very little to make this guy visually interesting.
He was an oil rig worker who was crushed by a big oil drum and then rebuilt by a shadow organization, and the only thing they want in return is for him to kill Daredevil. Yet his mission was apparently to just get past Daredevil and get these papers. So, a little conflicted there.
Also, the weird choice to put Peter in a green suit, so all the panels with him by the shrubbery and everything create a slight visual, you know.
He's an investigative reporter. Spidey finds and engages Ramrod, and Daredevil and the Black Widow join in, and they do recover the papers. Spidey is sent off with the papers, and Daredevil and the Black Widow fight on. I mean, it's their book after all. Ramrod, though, he charges like the Juggernaut, but he can jump travel like the Hulk. And he manages to catch up to Spidey, even though Spidey had a pretty good head start. By the way that it seems like time flows in this sequence, webbing through the city, and Ramrod catches up to him, and they all duel on the side of a building until Ramrod loses his grip and wonk, hits the pavement. And in a panel that, it's pretty Looney Tunes, Andrew, his legs are sticking up out of the pavement. It's and then Peter gets his interview.
Yeah, which they don't treat us to that wonderful interview. You know, maybe next time we'll get a bonus material where they'll include. It'd be great back matter to have the Parker interview.
Marvel Team-Up number 13 is Spider-Man and Captain America, written by Len Wein with art by Gil Kane and Frank Giacoa.
Now, unlike yourself, Steve, I was never great at identifying art teams, but the Gil Kane upturned nose slashes
sure
always were a great marker. The other thing that's going to happen, not to spoil an events plot point, but whenever the characters are gassed or about to knock out, he puts those light kind of starry circles around.
Yeah.
Because I remember that too. And those are two things that I could, even a relative slow-witted individual such as myself could point out that, wow, that's a guy I know.
I always see the arm, the bicep coming out of the shoulder and know that it's a Gil Kane. Or how about the knee? Oh my gosh, the knee and the calves, like, you know, the front-on shot. Yeah, very Gil Kane.
And he's like one of my other favorites, Ditko. He always does a lot of interesting things with fingers and hands and everything, too.
Yeah, he really took advantage of the fact that the Spider-Man's gloves are webbed, you know, so his fingers would really be nicely contorted. I think he's one of the first artists to really play that up.
Yeah, I mean, it's comic books, man. Got to have some fun with this stuff. It's not... I mean, it can be life drawing if you want, but you can also just make silly good fun with it.
Issue 13 opens down on the docks with Nathaniel from way back from Marvel Team-Up number 2, the same guy who was giving Johnny Storm a pep talk, is giving Peter some advice. But soon after, poor Nathaniel is killed by the return of the Gray Gargoyle.
Man, this is a guy I always had... He was one of those villains that, because I encountered him quite young, I always really liked. And I felt that, unlike a lot of Marvel villains, he played the field. You could see him against all, you know, I think he fought Thor at one point, and obviously Cap and everything. So I always liked when it was I enjoyed those, like, hero-villain dichotomies, but I also liked the guys that would just show up in a random book somewhere.
I also love this era when villains would explain how they got out of whatever predicament their last defeat left them in, you know, and then what comic it was. In this case, it was Cap, I think 152, when Cap blasted the Grey Gargoyle into space on a rocket, and he lands here on next to the dock and takes out poor Nathaniel. Spidey is looking for some action. The San Francisco trip, it didn't recharge his soul the way he had hoped it would. So
wow, you don't just forget your dead girlfriend because you went on a trip.
He goes on patrol and helps Captain America totally decimate an AIM enclave. I mean, bodies are hanging out of windows, Andrew, and every other panel is AIM beehive guys getting just totally trashed.
And I love these. They put the folds in the clothes with the like they really look like they're wearing the baggy beehive classic AIM.
Yeah,
these AIM guys, I could deal with a whole comic full of them.
Every panel, I'm thinking these guys are not enhanced and the heroes are just destroying them, including when they leave the scene, there's like a guy hanging out of the broken glass window, like presumably on a bunch of broken glass that's sticking up through him. Oh, man, it's brutal.
Well, I can't imagine being a regular human and getting hit with Cap's shield. It just seems like that would... You're not bouncing back from that in a hurry.
Nick Fury teleports the two aboard the helicarrier, and well, he pretty much voluntells them to retrieve some doohickey that AIM stole.
And this is a Nick I love. I love the imperious, not very realistic, sort of chomping on the cigar kind of Nick Fury. I don't know. I can see how people are like, oh, come on, this guy's not very... realistic, I guess, but I like this Nick. Like, it's a comic book. I don't mind the heightened kind of rush that the story goes through and how he just explains stuff and everything. Like, it's fine. It's fun.
It all comes together in kind of a rushed way because, well, the Grey Gargoyle has already risen to power and taken charge of this particular AIM faction that has the doohickey. So Cap and Spidey show up, and they have it out with the Grey Gargoyle.
And I want to give compliments again to the team for what could arguably be lack of contrast because he's entirely gray. The gimmick is he's made of stone. I feel like they do a lot to give him those shadows. Again, the folds in the cloak and things like that to break up what could, you know, easily be a not interesting looking character.
Because he's stone and his clothes are stone too, like, can he take off the little domino mask that he's wearing or no?
I assumed all that was sort of
stuck.
Somewhat stuck, but I imagine the cape had a little bit of give, perhaps. Because otherwise, I gotta think it would have cracked or chips of it would have come off.
He swings it around.
I thought it was kind of like Colossus with the living metal. I picture it more like a living stone.
Yeah. There's a cool sequence when Spidey's shooting his webbing at the Grey Gargoyle and he just holds up his hand and the webbing is turned to stone just as it's reaching, just before it like reaches his hand when it gets into the kind of the effect aura of his power. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
The Grey Gargoyle gets the upper hand and turns both Cap and Spidey into stone. Then, Andrew, he chains them to a missile. He's going to launch the missile and launch their petrified bodies into space. But while his back is turned, they miraculously recover. They take out the Grey Gargoyle. It's comical. He gets his leg caught in the chain that has been loosened from our heroes escaping. And when the rocket blasts off, it like catches his leg. It's horrific. He's screaming, in pity's name, stop the countdown, he's screaming. Nope. He just gets shot off into space, which is where he was left the last time he fought Captain America.
Well, I enjoyed the dichotomy of him going to blast Cap in for getting him trapped, and then him having the same fate visited upon him. But I really thought it was pretty lame that they just were immune to his powers, and they try and give some one-liner about it. That part, really, I thought they could have worked some other way around it.
Well, how the heck did they recover? With Cap, they mentioned that he had not that long ago been poisoned by the Viper's venom, and maybe, and then nothing is even said, and then Cap says, and I'll quote him, Heaven only knows what saved Spider-Man. That's all we get for an explanation. Like, they were turned to stone by the Great Gargoyle, and it just turned off right before they were blasted into space, and there's no... They didn't even try, Andrew. They didn't even try.
Yeah. There would have been no good ex. I feel they could have worked it. Maybe that the AIM guys lure them into some trap door that knocks them onto the thing or whatever. A better explanation than,
how about,
oh, they're not immune to his power. It just wears off really quickly.
How about one disgruntled AIM guy who was, you know, in charge, who the Grey Gargoyle took over, and he's, you know, he's bitter about it, and he injects the heroes with a preventive antidote thing that makes the stuff wear off that he's been developing to protect himself and the rest of his inner circle that are loyal to him if they ever have to face down the Gargoyle.
You know, I like that. Right. You should get a no prize for
that
one.
Thank you.
That works. It works better than the, oh, they're just immune to... They're not immune. Even if they had been immune so that they didn't turn to stone, I would have felt better. But the fact that it just wears off seems a little... But anyways, I liked all the rest of it. Gotta love this era Cap. He's got very prominent wings on his head.
Yes,
and he's
he
got
does.
The chain mail that he's wearing. This is, again, a Cap of an era that I can relate to.
Marvel Team-Up 14 is Spider-Man and Sub-Mariner. Written by Len Wein, with art by Gil Kane and W. Howard. I don't know if that's a pseudonym or an inker who didn't have a too prolific of a career, but I'm not familiar with W. Howard, Andrew.
I didn't feel that the issue suffered any great... like, it didn't... feel like there was some problem with it, so hats off to W. Howard.
Marvel
Team Again... We're going to get some prominent wings, Steve.
This is true. On the other end. Marvel Team-Up 14 starts with Spider-Man saving a guy from a mugging. But the guy, it's the Sub-Mariner. Then he, as soon as he determines that it's a Sub-Mariner, then they fight for 4 pages because kind of Spider-Man just all of a sudden decides that he doesn't like him just because.
Well, to be fair... Submariner's flooded New York City. He's launched how many surface wars against the hired Daredevil to sue the surface world people? This is right before he gets his blue vest superhero remake. He's still in his, you know, Olympic swimmer, just trunks only look.
The hostilities cease when Namor finally explains that he's after the Tiger Shark. And Tiger Shark is then seen plotting with Dr. Dorcas. Unfortunate name, Andrew.
Well, he's a bad guy, so it's fine. Well,
but the dude made Tiger Shark an orca, though, so you got to give him props.
Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting, kind of like the Tinkerer, like a behind-the-scenes villain that doesn't really get into the fisticuffs, but he's going to create some problems for you.
So your first two creations are Tiger Shark and Orca, two characters that are still around in the Marvel Universe, right? What's going to be his third creation, Andrew? It's going to be a foursome of creatures. It's the Menfish.
Well, he has to go that order, because if it's Fishmen, then it doesn't... It sounds like some kind of... You know, we already have all sorts of various mermen and merpeople and Atlanteans and all that. But the Menfish, I mean, I don't think that name's been used, Steve.
What are you, some kind of Dorcas?
And so, what I like is that one of them looks... They look... Half of them look more like bugs than they do sea creatures.
Dorcas's headquarters are on a ship out in sea, so Namor and Spidey have to get there, and the mode of transportation is Namor swimming really fast with Spidey... web skiing behind him. It's a great image.
I always enjoyed the era of Spider-Man making stuff out of his webbing.
Yeah.
Which I feel I guess it's too silly for the modern era, but I always liked when he would cobble some simple device. Oh, it's made out of webbing.
Spidey and Namor show up and do their thing and fight the bad guys, and they appear to win, but they've been tricked and they've been poisoned, because every time they were punching out one of their foes, they were being poisoned.
And this is where the little circles with the flashes that I remember that is Gil Kane to me happen.
It's
and in the same panel, I get the flashes of light and I get the upturned nose, Steve. So there's no, that one panel lets me know I'm exactly on board.
And you know how it goes. They get imprisoned. They escape imprisonment. Namor fights and defeats the Tiger Shark, and Spidey takes on the Menfish for a minute, but they've got to run because the base is about to explode, and it does.
And I really like this one. I thought was a better payoff, where Tiger Shark and Namor, they're being dried out, and Namor can't figure out how Tiger Shark is doing it till he figures, oh, his outfit must be circulating liquid. So I thought that was a better explanation of what's going on and payoff than in our previous issue. I was like, I really like that.
Is it like when you pee in your spacesuit?
I'm hoping that's not what the liquid that was circulating was.
And don't worry about the Menfish, because we'd see them again in Submariner 70 and 71, and in the much more recent Marvel Zombies 4. Issues 1 and 2, which I got to go seek out, because now I'm all about the Menfish.
Well, they seem like they could, you know, Daredevil had those, the Wally Wood issue early on, where he invented those crazy animal-human hybrids.
Oh my gosh, yeah, he did. Issue 15 of Marvel Team-Up is Spider-Man and the Ghost Rider. Written by Len Wein, with art by Ross Andrew and Don Perlin.
This is the reason why I picked this series. I wanted this to cover it in, because I'm going to say, now, I'm always envious of those people that can remember exactly what age and the circumstances and things from their youth. I'm going to say I was probably about 7 years old, give or take. And I got Marvel Treasury Edition number 18.
Yep.
And that included this story. It also actually included the Jack Russell one,
yep.
But I didn't really remember that one. This one is burned into my, I could have been anywhere between 6 to 8. And I didn't, for those of you that aren't aware, the Treasury Editions were oversized. So it was a really impressive comic book. And I only got a few of them as a kid, but I really appreciated them. My reading comprehension would have been, I would have been able to read this and get most of it at that age. But there's a sequence when the villain reveals his
absolutely
visage.
That's why I remember this
today. Like, I don't remember a lot from when I was seven. But
we'll give it its props when we get there. The Treasury Editions, Andrew, at the newsstand I used to buy my comics at, they would be stacked flat, you know, on the bottom row of shelf, like with the newspapers and the, you know, sports magazines and stuff. It was cool. Big Treasury Editions.
Yeah, no one would have given me money at that age, so this had to have been a gift from someone, and likely my first exposure to Ghost Rider. I don't think I would have. I was pretty much at that age just getting the basic, like, Spider-Mans and that kind of thing. So it was a cool character that I had no awareness of.
I absolutely love the splash page of this issue. Mary Jane is making her green bell bottoms work, man.
Oh, yeah. And just Spider-Man. I love that. He's nervously looking at a spider balloon.
She's on a date with Peter. She's taking him to see the Ghost Rider's, like, carny show. 5 days a week, Andrew. Who needs Johnny Blaze?
I don't need him. And they have Roxanne Simpson. Yeah, it's the whole crew of, like... And for some reason, as a little kid, I don't have much interest in motorcycles now. But when I was a kid, they seemed...
Heck yeah.
You know, I was coming up... Evel Knievel
exactly.
was...
Exactly.
I can't tell people how big, for like this 4-year reign, if you look at old comics, you'll see the toy on the back, but Evel Knievel was just everywhere. It was inexplicable. He came and he went.
Joe Sinnott did the art of that ad that was on the back of those comics that we all remember. Isn't that crazy?
They were very memorable, but for some reason, Evel Knievel seized the fever for like a 4-year, what, I don't know exactly how long, but for this narrow window, everybody knew who he was.
It was something
and
like
everybody was obsessed.
You know, it was the Hells Angels had Altamont happen early in the 70s, so they had all of a sudden became legendary, and you had the Evel Knievel thing. You had, how about Chips? right? Chips was pretty popular. Yeah. All that stuff. Funny.
And he's in his blue jumpsuit, which looks so good.
And Peter and Mary Jane in the stands are totally entertained and impressed by the Ghost Rider's motorcycle stunts. But then the Orb and his motorcycle gang show up. In fact, it's the first appearance of the Orb. He's got the red outfit and the, you know, the big neckerchief around his neck and the big eyeball on his head. Man.
And again, hypnotism plays a key role. Instant hypnotism. But Peter was smart to turn his head.
Real smart. But the Orb kidnaps Roxanne Simpson, who is Johnny Blaze's girlfriend. Johnny Blaze is the Ghost Rider's human counterpart. Not that we ever see him this whole issue. He's in Ghost Rider form this entire issue.
I'm fine with that, Steve. He's all right, but I'm here for the Ghost Rider.
But it was weird to set up that Roxanne is his girlfriend and have them, like, backstage before the show. And it's weird that he was, like, Ghost Rider all the time. And that he was even doing a carnival show as Ghost Rider is weird to me. But anyway.
Hey, Steve, it's the 70s. Do you want to look like some regular dude, or do you want to have a flaming skull when you walk around?
Spidey and the Ghost Rider are not able to prevent the Orb's escape with Roxanne.
A dynamic panel of some motorcycle stunts also stayed with me. The sequence where Spider-Man gets kicked in the stomach by one of the Orb's henchmen. That's another panel that I remember from many, many years ago. And then the Orb uses the hypnotized people to create a barrier so he can escape.
Did you do silly putty on that panel or something, Andrew?
I thought it was such a great view of the guy because he's standing on his seat and he does this nice sidekick. It's composed with Spidey punching another guy. Just one of those, when you're a kid, certain images latch in and you're like, that looks like so... There's so much going on in one little panel, and it tells you what happened before and after. And then you start on the horrific sequence, which has scarred me to this day.
Yeah, what's the Orb's endgame? You think it would be Roxanne Simpson, right? That's not bad loot. That's not a bad consolation prize. But no, what he wants is complete ownership of Johnny Blaze's carny cycle show, right? Which Ghost Rider's like, all right, I'll give it to him. That's what he wants? Sure. The Orb explains his origin to Roxanne. He was her father's partner, Drake Shannon. How about that for a soap opera name?
And it was a great little, they get this whole sequence of the, they were in a race to win it all.
And Drake cheated and bumped Simpson, but Drake took the fall, not Simpson. And the fall was 25 yards at 95 miles an hour on his face. And that's when he takes off his helmet, and it was even more horrible in Treasury Edition size, yes. Andrew, because they pulled no punches. It's like, it's hideous.
Yeah, it's a misshapen, miscolored, a handful of teeth, like the eyes are blood. It was, like I said, I remember that to this day, being like, oh my, because it just comes out of nowhere. Like, you know, he's... damage, but we've seen people, and normally it's like, oh, some scars or whatever, but this guy, he's got the full treatment.
It's like Bernie Wrightson's Jennifer, you know, but it's like in a Marvel comic. It's atrocious.
So well done. Like,
and that's what's under that eyeball, you know, in all the subsequent appearances of the Orb in the Ghost Rider, including that one that I just love that has the Ernie Chan cover on it. Oh, man. The Ghost Rider never looked so good, but I'm always thinking of that face is underneath that big Orb helmet.
I can't recommend enough for any 7-year-olds that are listening.
The Ghost Rider shows up and concedes to the Orb's demands and gives him the ownership documents that he craves, but... you know, the Orb can't really let them leave alive, so his armed goon squads are lined up to do their thing, but Spidey shows up and the goon squads are really no match for the Ghost Rider and Spidey. Spidey, how'd he show up? A spider tracer.
And a nice motorcycle chase with Spidey on a motorcycle. And before you say, how can he do it? There's no way with his enhanced reflexes, I feel like he'd actually be pretty good because he can react a lot quicker than a regular person. You know, if he can web swing and do complicated maneuvers, he should be able to. And he also mentions, you know, that he used to have a little motorcycle back in the day.
And why do they need to be on cycles chasing? Because the orb escaped on his bike with Roxanne again. All right. And so they chase him, and then they chase him, and they chase him, and they chase him, and then they get to up a stairwell through a set of doors, and all of a sudden they're in the middle of Grand Central Station in the terminal.
Spidey. It was a fun, like, no roads at all, by the way. Like, this is all, you know, subways and stairwells and stuff. I really liked it.
Spidey grabs Roxanne with a web while the Ghost Rider chases the orb down onto the subway tracks. The Ghost Rider leaps to safety to avoid an oncoming train, but the orb, not so much.
Well, and also the Ghost Rider's bike gets crushed too, Steve. A much bigger loss.
Yeah, they hadn't yet established that he makes it out of Hellfire.
Yeah, well, like I said, this was the only Ghost Rider story I had as a kid, and I was like, whoa, this guy is something else. I was very... That one I really dug, and especially in the oversized format.
The first appearance of villains streak continues here in Marvel Team-Up issue 16. It's Spider-Man and Captain Marvel, written by Len Wein, art by Gil Kane, with inks by Jim Mooney and uncredited Dave Hunt.
This is basically going to populate... These issues are all going to create all the people that Scourge is then going to end up killing.
This is the Basilisk. It's his first appearance. He's that reptilian guy who's bald with the eye beams.
And the green lizard, because obviously he's parodying... taking his cue from the mythological creature that can turn people to stone.
So I don't think I've ever read this issue before. I don't know where the basilisk came from. So I was diving right in. I was like, ooh, okay, let's go. The issue opens with Rick Jones hurrying down the street. Captain Marvel wants him to go get the Alpha Stone. This is the time where Rick Jones and Captain Marvel are both wearing the Nega Bands, and they occupy the same physical space on Earth, and when they clank it together, they switch, and the other guy is stuck, imprisoned, floating around in the negative zone.
It's so hard to believe that Captain Marvel's been gone for like 40 years or something. Like, it's kind of crazy.
The Alpha Stone itself is in the process of being robbed by a crook named Basil Elks. Oh, man.
How dare... And so it's Jack Russell for you, Steve?
and he says his own name out loud several times while he's committing the crime. I don't know if this is before the era of security cameras, but please. But he steals it, though a security guard comes up on him. The stone gets shot and shattered, and it turns Basil into the Basilisk.
I like the whole coincidence, and this is like 4 pages or 3 pages or something. I like that they're going to get right down to it and not mess around.
His power is serious stuff, though. He can transmute matter with his eye beams.
So far, Steve, we've covered 2 stories that have heavy hypnotism and 2 stories where people can transmute people into... elements. Are we finding a pattern in these?
Well, Peter just happens to be walking by and hears a blast as the basilisk makes his getaway through the museum wall. That's how he gets brought into it. As Spider-Man, they fight for a few pages, and that's when Rick finally arrives on scene. Clank go the Nega Bands, and Captain Marvel is there to help.
And I was never sure if he also was given... I have to assume he was given somewhat enhanced strength to be able to knock out Petey so quick.
They fight for a few pages, but the basilisk is able to escape. In the oddest manner, he propels himself upward with his eye beams, like force against the ground. I mean, that's got to feel like being lifted up by, like, your eye sockets or, like, by your... Like, the weight of your body being lifted by your skull? Ouch.
Well, I'm pretty sure this is where the Marvel Cinematic Universe got the idea for Iron Man.
But while he's in the air, he manages to like turn around and like shoot at targets with his eye beams, and it doesn't like he's not.
Well, he takes a little dip while he, and then he turns it back on the.
Oh, it's very awkward.
There's a lot of collateral damage. But one of the things I loved about this era, because we haven't quite overpowered everybody, you can have Spider-Man and Captain Marvel, who's clearly much stronger, but it's not like he's can destroy everything and Spider-Man can destroy everything. So I feel that having powers step down a little can make these team-up and villain fights a little more believable.
Captain Marvel explains that the Alpha Stone was Kree, and that there is a twin Omega Gem. And so they've got to prevent the Basilisk from reaching it, and that's the Basilisk's goal. It's buried at a construction site where everyone converges, and they fight for another 4 or 5 pages.
Very well done, too. Exciting. Like I said, lots of cool panels and punches and counters. And
it all ends very strangely. Spidey's fighting on, and Mar-Vell uncovers the Omega Stone from the ground, and all of a sudden it grows large and encases Mar-Vell, like entraps him. And then it blinks out of existence.
I love how the Basilisk takes off again using his eye blast. It's like, you may have outwitted me. And I love how Spider-Man's outwitted you. I don't even know what's going on. Same here, Spidey. I don't know. But I liked how suddenly you're in a two-parter. I'm sure the fans in 1973 might not have been so happy, but I think it's cool. You're like, whoa, two-parter.
So in our last issue of this chunk is Marvel Team-Up issue 17, just right at the end of 1973. It's Spider-Man and Mr. Fantastic. The story by Len Wein, the art by Gil Kane, with inks by everybody, and it's like written in bubble letters. They mean everybody.
Well, they all pitch in. And this is, again, going back to our shared universe. Steve, if something weird happens, you have two people to talk to, like Mr. Fantastic or Doctor Strange, you know. Maybe if you're desperate, the Avengers. But I always loved them, this whole, like, well, I gotta go get help from my superhero buddies.
Yeah, Cap wasn't as accessible as he would become a decade or so later.
But also, what's he going to do? Tell you about how it was in the 40s and how, you know, beer used to cost a nickel and everything? Like,
you
gotta
get back
that
up when you fall down. So Spider-Man is seeking out help from the Fantastic Four, and he starts out making the same old mistake he made in Amazing Spider-Man number 1. He sneaks in, sets off the building's defenses until he's trapped.
But it's a good way to get their attention. Look, unfortunately, he gets the worst of the four, Mr. Fantastic, but what are you going to do, Steve?
Only Reed is home, and we've seen this in one of the Marvel team-up issues with Johnny Storm, where it's like they're disappointed that it was Johnny who was home. Now it's, well, you know what? Spidey will take any help he can get. But the problem is, Reed is saying the Fantastic Four is totally disbanded over a disagreement. And what he's referring to is when Reed had to shut down Franklin's brain when he was like too powerful. And the group broke up between Fantastic Four issues 142 and 144. So this story must take place right in between there. Spidey explains the whole deal with the Basilisk and the jewels and Captain Marvel and everything, but Reed has pretty much lost his mojo, and he doesn't want to help until Spidey shames him into helping.
Yeah, but it's all done in like 2 pages or something, or 3, or like it's well done, but it's done quickly.
Reed pilots a craft to track the Omega Gem all the way to the center of the Earth.
Oh man, and if you thought I liked all those AIM guys, man, I love piles of moloids are loads of fun. Like it's just, I can, all these. We talked about it recently in our Starlin one. Whenever there's an army of bad guys, I just love how much work goes in and the I don't know. You can just stare at those pages for a long time.
When you go underground in the Marvel Universe, especially in the Bronze Age, you know you're going to get besieged by the Moloids. It's just got to happen.
And some Kirby tech as well is going to be involved.
They hold their own against the Moloids, but they get taken out by good old knockout gas. And the Mole Man has this giant laser cannon built out of Kirby tech, powered by the Earth's molten magma and focused through the giant Omega Stone with Mar-Vell inside. He's not going to survive the experience when they fire this thing.
Well, you know, you got to break a few eggs to make your omelet, Steve.
What I don't get is he constructed this device many months ago and I guess just got lucky that the big gemstone appeared. And did it just appear? Like, where did it go and why did it just go and disappear at the end of the other issue? That never gets... They don't even try, Andrew.
Well, there's a lot of science and magic mixed together. And if you don't like their science, well, just take them from them. It's magic.
Reed and Spidey escape being pumped into the magma pit and stand ready to take on the Moloid army. But suddenly they're all turned to glass. It's the Basilisk. He has arrived. He followed Spidey and Reed to get at the gem.
Although he's, it must be so damaging when he flies across the city, just crushing those beams down.
I love seeing Reed use his powers, too, to, like, he launches himself out of the pit, and he slingshots himself around and turns himself into a ball, and I love all that stuff.
Yeah, he is visually interesting. I just never really responded. I always thought the way he treated Sue was just terrible.
We would have treated her so much better, Andrew.
Exactly. She could see I'm a real sensitive man. Not like that buffoon in his lab all day.
The Mole Man and Basilisk both want the gem, so they fight each other. And while that happens, our heroes try to free Mar-Vell. But then the bad guys realize, oh my gosh, they're trying to free Mar-Vell. And then they kind of call a truce and go after our heroes. Finally, Mar-Vell just frees himself by changing back to Rick Jones, and it makes the gem turn back into a little stone, which I guess he should have done a lot sooner, Andrew.
Well, to be fair, if he was surrounded by a million Moloids, what's Rick Jones going to do? Play him a terrible song? Like, there isn't a lot he can do to fight. Yeah, he'd be free, but then he's surrounded. Now he has some allies to help him, which helps.
So you're saying the real reason that Dr. Banner tackled him off of his Jeep in the middle of that test field was to get him to stop playing that damn harmonica.
Exactly. Well, doesn't he sometimes have an acoustic guitar? It depends, on sure. Who's redoing it. But yeah, I also like how the Moloids are just, they are the prototypical cannon fodder pawns that just get wiped out by the truckload here. So if you're, you know, a pro-Moloid guy, this is not a good issue.
The gem goes kerplunk into the magma lava, and the Basilisk chases after it right into the lava like he's Gollum going after his precious ring, you know? And then the Mole Man gets caught in a cave-in, and all the loose ends are wrapped up.
Yeah, quite quickly, but what are you going to do? I mean, we're not gonna make this a three-parter, Steve. I know you're asking for it, but two was enough.
All right, well, that's a good chunk of old classic Marvel team-up issues.
Fun. Well, I had to stop there, Steve, because 18 doesn't have Spider-Man in it, and I'm not going to read some stupid Human Torch Hulk team-up.
I will for you, you know? But in the meantime, listen for new episodes every couple of weeks here on Marvel Noise as we keep our rhythm going. And stay safe and keep enjoying comic books in between.
Yeah, and feel free to read some of these old comic books. They're always a hoot. And that Marvel Unlimited, I mean, I just happen to have these books, but Marvel Unlimited is really great. They usually, you know, you just click the next and the next one pops up.
So until Rick Jones makes it a three-parter, make mine Marvel. Later.
I would love to tour the Southland in a traveling minstrel show. Yes, I'd love to Southland in a traveling minstrel show. Yes, I'm down to be a star and make them laugh. Sound just like a record on a phonograph. Those days are gone forever, over a long time ago. Oh yeah. Hey, hey! I have never met Napoleon, but I plan to find the time. So fine up on that hill. They tell me he was lonely, he's lonely still. Those days are gone forever, over a long time ago. Oh yeah. The man gave me the news. He said, "You must be joking, son. Where did you get those shoes?"